How's that? That's better, thank you. It does seem a little bit abrupt, perhaps. I've been outside admiring your lovely quiet time in here and thinking, well, I'm going to come in and talk about cancer. Sadly, I'm a very passionate cancer nerd, and I really can talk about it at the drop of a hat. And I agreed to talk tonight having no idea what to expect, no idea how many people, but really with coming from the viewpoint that cancer is common, it is a problem for our society, and the more people know about it, the better. I hope I can entertain you as well as just some of what I say will be quite confronting for some people. I'll be talking about people who die. And what I'm really going to do is kind of tell you my own story and at the same time kind of do what I would call a virtual ward round of some of my patients, people whose care I've been involved in, and the learnings that I at least have gained from those people. I think it's actually a fantastic story in the sense that because of things that my patients have said to me, that led to the formation of Solaris, and literally tens of thousands of Western Australians and their carers have been helped with what we rather cliche now to say the cancer journey. So yes, I'll tell you about my journey, my story, and that becomes the story of Solaris, and I'll tell you about a number of people I met along the way. So I should explain what a hematologist is. I can tell you it's a great way to stop conversation at a dinner party if you say you're a hematologist. It's a good way to get the person next to you in the plane to stop talking. But basically we do a double specialist training. On the one hand, we do the physician's training that basically gives us a license to look after people in hospital with things like leukemia, lymphoma, and myeloma. On the other hand, we do a pathologist training as well, which gives us a license to look at and issue reports on people's blood samples, bone marrow biopsies, molecular biology, supervise a blood bank, iron, blood clotting, and stuff like that. And I chose lucky. I chose something that has fascinated me and given me an enormously rewarding professional life. And I think, I don't know quite what inspired me, but it's worked out very well for me. So, as a hematologist, a little bit of my time is in the laboratory. 90 or 80% of my time is clinical, between clinics and ward rounds and meetings. And most of my clinical practice involves people with cancer. So I'm not an oncologist that looks after what we call the solid tumours, but I look after things like leukemia and lymphoma. So I trained locally. I went away for 4 years. I did a 2 years research job in Switzerland and 2 years clinical job in London, and was appointed as head of department at Charlie's in 1994. And in fact, that was my first job as a consultant, was also as a head of department. Those who appointed me had a bit of a political agenda, and it was a pretty tough initiation, actually, for me as a consultant. And after 4 or 5 years as a junior consultant, I formed the view that I still have that we make a bit of a meal of this business of looking after people with cancer. Specifically, I felt that the system was full of people who really wanted to help, but at its worst, through no fault of its own, it could be quite brutal. And I've lost count of the number of times medical colleagues have come to me and said, my wife, daughter, brother, myself has just been diagnosed and been through the mill, and now I get what you're on about. And it's a shame to me that it takes the first-hand experience to bring this home. to so many people in the professions. I should add that the scope of the cancer problem, we think that Australians who reach the age of 75, one in three men, one in four women, will be diagnosed with cancer. If you get to 85, it's one in two men and women. We currently have about 139,000 people diagnosed with cancer each year in Australia. Rule of tens, Western Australia, about 14,000 people a year. We estimate there's about 700,000 people living in Australia after a diagnosis of cancer. And so there's a lot of people around, and I know when I speak to an audience of this size, something like one in four people will have close first, second-hand experience of, unfortunately, something that Lance Armstrong calls the biggest club in the world, and membership isn't voluntary. So yes, a big problem. And one of the big issues for the large number of people whose lives are affected by cancer is the way the media portray it. And so you will see in the papers, and I have a colleague in London who's analysed a large number of media articles, cancer tends to be portrayed in a very pejorative way and in a very simplistic way as one disease. And the media kind of have this notion that you find a lump one way or another, you have treatment that makes you look or feel terrible, and then 3 months later you're alive or dead. And as I'll show you, that is actually so far from the truth. These days we regard cancer as a chronic illness much more than an acute medical emergency. So the kind of things that disquieted me as a young consultant were the long wait between a GP picking something up and being seen by a specialist, 6 or 8 weeks when you're worried that there's something in your body that's turning against you. Poor communication with family and with relatives, a lack of lifestyle advice. The focus was entirely on the tumour and its treatment and not on the person in whom the tumour had arisen. And with the increasing incidence of cancer, and it's been rising by about 3% a year across the board, people in the health system have less and less time to just sit and talk to patients. And so the humanity of the situation was not getting expressed. And I felt very strongly that we weren't doing this the right way. And I didn't consciously at first, but at that time I basically committed my professional life to trying to make this somehow be done better. So 1998 or 9, I'll introduce you to Roy. Roy is a man who's been cured of his lymphoma subsequently, but soon after he started chemotherapy for his lymphoma, he said to me that it had taken him 3 months to learn how to be a patient. Roy, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, I had to learn all this terminology about my tumour and all the words for the treatment. I had to learn how the treatment works. I had to learn the geography of the hospital. And I had to learn who I could talk to about what I was doing to help myself. And that was a little throwaway tag at the end of his answer. But that flicked my interest. And I said, Roy, what do you mean by that? Well, Doc, he said, we all sit out in the waiting room and we talk to each other. And we say, have you tried Latrile? Have you tried shark cartilage? Have you tried bush tea? Have you tried or heard about this treatment in Mexico or Germany? And the other person will say, well, yes, I've tried this or that, but for heaven's sake, don't tell Dr. X or Nurse Y, because they'll poo-poo you for doing something outside the mainstream. And this actually, for me, was a road to Damascus moment, whereby I realised that for me as a cancer doctor, and I knew that many, if not most, of my patients were trying stuff, that I would have to start buying into this issue of complementary and alternative medicine, or forever have a barrier whereby my patients would feel that they couldn't tell me all the things that they were doing to try and manage their situation, which in business terms we would say is being proactive. And so I set myself to, on top of all the haematology stuff that was happening and building a department and developing clinical trials, to reading around complementary and alternative medicine. And to my surprise, I found more evidence than I might have expected. And really I was trying to go towards being a doctor who looked like they had an open mind to encourage my patients to be able to talk to me very openly. But what I found surprised me, it wasn't in the high-powered, top-notch medical journals, but there was good, what we would call level two, which is up to the level of a randomized controlled trial, evidence for a whole lot of complementary therapies. Not cures. I'm not talking about cures. I'm not talking about reducing rates of relapse. But what I am talking about is evidence. For example, I'll give you several examples, and some of these have come along since 1998, obviously, but there's good evidence that massage is particularly good to release or reduce anxiety in people with cancer. There's very good evidence that acupuncture reduces the nausea caused by some chemo drugs, particularly when it involves what's called the P6 pressure point on the left wrist. There's a very good study done in a bone marrow transplant unit of particular interest to me in Seattle, which is very famous, the birthplace of bone marrow transplantation, in fact, showing that bone marrow transplant recipients, if they underwent some kind of music therapy, and music therapy can be active where you bang a drum or blow a pipe or strum a guitar, or passive, just listening to music, but people who had this had improved scores against depression and a reduced length of stay in hospital. I might add, if you start to talk about things like reduced length of stay, then the bean counters in health start to get interested because there's an economic angle on this now. Maybe that's me being a bit cynical. Just last year, there was a fascinating paper done where they looked at a whole lot of biological measures in the body of inflammation and stress in people with cancer and their carers who joined a choir. And they showed in three choirs across Wales reduced levels of cortisol, reduced inflammatory markers, reduced aging of white blood cells through joining a choir and singing. So there's a long history of this antipathy between complementary and alternative medicine and mainstream medicine. And being a bit of a history buff, it actually traces back to René Descartes, who wrote a treatise in 1641, and the subtitle of his book was called On the Distinction Between Mind and Body. And he argued that the mind was completely separate from the body. And René Descartes was very influential in starting the whole Western scientific method of doing careful studies, reducing all the variables to the one variable we're interested in, population-based, scientific, reductionist, hypothesis-testing, statistically-based Western science. And so along with all of that came Descartes' notion that the mind and body are separate. In 1912, the US government was very concerned about dodgy medical schools starting up. And so they commissioned a guy called Flexner to do a report. And his report concluded that the government should only fund those medical schools that taught, quote unquote, a physical basis of disease. The report was very influential in the US. About half of medical schools collapsed because the government stopped funding them. To a lesser extent, it was influential in the UK and therefore Australia. And so there currently in Australia is a body called the Friends of Science in Medicine, you might have heard of, who are saying that we should only promote those therapies which have a scientific rationale and for which there's good evidence. I subscribe to the latter, but not to the former. So I'm getting ahead of myself, but one of the treatments that we offer in Solaris is Reiki, which is a kind of hands-off massage. involving the concept of lines of energy around and outside the body that can be manipulated. And for the life of me, I can't see how, according to what I have learnt, how that might work. But and it was certainly our most controversial therapy that we started. There was a lot of backlash when we started Solaris from the mainstream practitioners. But we've done research and we've measured it, and we find that a lot of our patients have quite profound experiences during Reiki, for whatever reason, almost hallucinatory life experiences. And on that basis, and no evidence of harm, I'm happy to keep it going, even though I don't understand how it might work. The mind and the body are coming back together in mainstream medicine. And this is a science called psychoneuroimmunology. That's a bit of a mouthful. And so we are starting to be able to understand why depression changes how well the immune system works. We know now a lot more about how stress can affect the immune system. It can impair wound healing after surgery. It can blunt responses to vaccination, and so on. So the mind and the body, I believe, thankfully, are coming back together. When I was a young doctor in Port Hedland on a rotation, I witnessed a young Aboriginal man die despite, by everything that we could measure, having nothing wrong with him. Now, he'd committed a crime. He'd had a spear wound to his thigh and had the bone pointed. I don't think that's quite the right phrase for that particular people up there, but he believed, therefore, that he should die, and he did. And he had a perfectly normal set of blood counts and kidney tests and liver tests, and none of us could understand how it happened. And that was one experience that suggested to me, as a very young doctor, perhaps there is something in this mind stuff. All right, so Roy's comment, I did some reading, and then through a relative of a patient, they offered to get a company to support my desire to build a cancer support centre. And so we, it was Peters and Brown's Dairy at the time. We filmed an ad. It took 5 hours to film a 30-second ad with me as the talking head. And Peters donated 5 cents in a TV campaign in 2000 for every litre of milk sold towards a cancer support centre. And the PR guy in Peters, in fact, the PR lady in Peters said that my life would never be the same after I've been on TV in these free-to-air ads on 7, 9 and 10. And I can tell you I was very nervous. I'm basically a very conservative medical type and doctors don't go on TV. But my life didn't really change much. I got recognised once at the airport by the Qantas check-in lady who said, "Oh, you're the milk guy, aren't you?" And the other notable thing was that all of the kids at my daughter's primary school also thought I was a milkman for about 2 years. But apart from that, we raised the money. We converted where Westpac were in Sir Charles Gairdner Hospital into a cancer support centre and opened on September the 15th, 2001. And from that day to this, it's been 100 miles an hour. Even in the first week, we had about 100 people wander into the centre. It's moved now because we have a bigger new cancer centre, but it's moved and become bigger in itself. But we still have about 100 people a week, mostly Charlies, but it's open to anyone who come in. Sometimes they wander in, sometimes shell-shocked. They've just had what we call the bad news interview. We designed it like an Australian kitchen, like an Australian home with a kitchen area, sofa, made it as non-clinical as we could, and have had a couple of treatment rooms in the original centre. And the centres now function kind of in three ways. One is just a quiet place, come in and have a cup of tea, just assimilate the news or talk to one of our meet and greet volunteers. Second level is that we provide information for all of the various cancer support organisations, the Cancer Council, the Breast Foundation, Leukemia Foundation, Myeloma Foundation, and so on. And then the third level, and the controversial decision, was to offer patients a range of selected complementary therapies. Now, this was in 2001, and it was certainly the first centre in Australia, and possibly the first in the Southern Hemisphere, I suspect, to do this. And basically, I was putting my professional reputation into the hands of a group of therapists outside the mainstream health system, a group of therapists that the mainstream health system had rejected for literally 300 years, and really trusting them to do what we'd asked them to do and not cause any harm. We have to be careful because cancer patients are a vulnerable population. They are often desperately looking for hope. And we took a number of steps to reduce any risk of harm for people, psychological or physical, and actually we got it right. And now 15, 17 years later, we still had no major medical misadventure. A couple of years after we started, we formed a research committee, and my philosophy was to be as inclusive as we could, to make it free for people, to offer it to carers and to staff as well, and to not just do it, but measure it. Because the long-term answer to the skeptics is to produce the evidence that says it's helpful. Doctors, however conservative and crusty and reactionary they may be, will listen to good evidence. And so we committed ourselves to starting a body of work to collect that. And we've published about 12 papers now that are contributing to the literature on the fact that a lot of these, what I would call very ancient forms of healing, can tuck in alongside all the best of high-tech Western medicine, the latest genes and targeted drugs and so on, and really help address cancer symptoms and treatment side effects. And there have been some unexpected lessons along the way, but just to fill in the details of the story a bit, by about 2006, the centre was massively subscribed. We had other places which wanted to become part of Solaris, and it became obvious that we needed to develop a standalone foundation. And again, this was a kind of nervous period for me. I had a bit of a crisis of, I suppose you would say a crisis of self-confidence in 2006 for a couple of weeks, realising that if I start a foundation, there's going to be all these people coming in behind this who are locking me into this and are really going to be following what we're doing in Solaris, and that's a big responsibility. Until finally I decided that the motivation for doing this was actually because I believe it's the right thing to do for people. And that being the case, if the moral compass is telling you it's probably okay, then just keep going. And if people choose to come in as well, that's great, but that's up to them. So we formed a foundation in 2006, had an official opening. We opened a second centre at St John of God's in Subi, where there's a big private cancer hospital or department, the Jack Bendat Comprehensive Cancer Centre. Then we bought a property and opened a centre in Bunbury because under the state cancer plan, mainstream cancer services were being ramped up in Bunbury with radiation starting down there and so on. And then a centre in Albany. And then last year we amalgamated with the Cancer Support Association in Cottesloe, who were, I would judge, two alternatives some years ago, but came back to the fold, and it's been a very, very successful merger. And so the state of the moment, the state of play at the moment for Solaris is that we have about 350 volunteers. We're one of the biggest volunteer organisations in the state. We do about 700 treatments a month across five centres. We have treated now about 12,000 Western Australians, according to our records, and we're publishing in this area of using these sorts of things to help people get through their cancer. And to give you an example of this, I'll tell you about Donald. Donald was a man under my care. He was a retired surgeon, and he'd been through a number of lines of treatment. And in fact, he was on the ward, had been on the ward for about 6 weeks, and was dying. I'm sorry to put it bluntly, but that was the truth. And he was in a state of enormous agitation, just literally unable to sit still, agitated depression, and totally freaked out by the circumstances he found himself in. And on a Thursday ward round, I suggested to him that he go and try something in Solaris, thinking that as a surgeon, he'd probably be the last person to try something like this. And then I saw him on the Saturday morning, the next ward round, and he was a changed man. And he said he'd had a session of Reiki, lying there for an hour with a volunteer waving their hands over his body. And somewhere in the course of that hour, he'd come to see that his time was limited, and what he needed to do actually was get home and spend as much time as he could with his kids. And he was settled and far more at peace with his situation. Not hopeless, but far more at peace. And his hopes were now changed from being able to beat his cancer to, okay, maybe I can't, but I can still have some useful time with my family. This concept of hope is terribly important. I think it's part of the human condition is to be hopeful. And I remember looking after a woman in her 80s who'd been told she only had a few months to live from a rare bone marrow disorder at another hospital. And she came to me with a very anxious husband, a Polish couple, for a second opinion. And I said, well, you know, we've seen this before, and there are a few things that I've tried which occasionally have had really unexpectedly good control of this for sometimes even years. And so her care came over to us, and I tried one thing or another, and she managed to have, despite the fact she needed regular blood transfusion, she managed to have most of about 8 months at home. And after she died, her husband gave me a wood carving of an owl, which in Polish society is a sign of wisdom. Now, I don't actually think that my prognosis was too much different to my colleagues in another hospital in her case. But the way the message is packaged is hopeful, and that allows her to cope much better with the situation and to remain human. And so one of the things that just appalls me is the occasional story I hear of doctors being utterly dismissive and saying, well, you know, there's nothing more we can do. There's actually always something you can do. By way of a diversion, I would like to also tell you about Alison, who in the early 2000s had been under my care for several years with a disease called multiple myeloma. And Alison was a diminutive little lady who always came into her appointments with me elegantly coiffured, and her currency of communication with me was denial, which isn't a great way to handle a situation, but that was clearly the way she chose to manage her illness. And so she'd come in and say, we're going to beat this, aren't we, Doc? Tell me what to do. Don't tell me anything else, and I'll just do what you say. And she didn't want to talk about it. And we went through several lines of treatment. She had a terrible disease. Until one Monday morning, I had to come to her on the ward and say, look, I'm sorry, but Alison, I've run out of rabbits to pull out of the hat here. There aren't any more treatments that really have a very good chance of working. There might be, there's always something else I can try, but I think you need to understand the gravity of the situation. And she made a little joke and laughed, and then I headed off to my clinic. And what happened next was pretty incredible, and the nurses on the ward told me that she called in her partner and her mother, who were estranged, and got them to reconcile. And then at 3 o'clock that afternoon, she died. And I'm still not quite sure I can explain that, except to say that the way she chose to manage her cancer was to deny it until it was inescapable, and then do what she needed to do, and then, having made that peace, she felt that she could let go. And the story brings home to me the power of words, the fact that the things that we say to people can have such an incredible impact in this setting. People say to me that my job must be incredibly stressful and horrible, and I say, actually, no, it's the great thing about my job is that it really matters, and I see people at their best. It's not like I'm working in a travel agent or a call centre and people are yelling at me about this or that. When they come and see me, I see people at their best, and I'm still amazed day in, day out by the dignity and the bravery that Australians show managing this group of illnesses. It's a great privilege, actually. All right, so alongside these kinds of stories, I could tell you of other patients. For example, Catherine, who I first met in 1999. And long story short, she was the first person in Western Australia treated with a medicine called Gleevec. And Gleevec is four tablets a day, and it was the first drug where it was designed to match the abnormal gene in the cancer cell. It was the first what we call targeted therapy. This is what the press call a magic bullet, because it means a treatment that will only affect those cells that have the abnormality in, that is the cancer cells, and that means much less chance of side effects on the rest of the body. Unlike chemo, which is pretty blunt treatment designed to hit any cell in the body that's dividing at the time. And Gleevec was an astonishing justification of the whole thing about modern science and all of the fruits of molecular biology, because we designed this particular drug, and for four tablets a day, Catherine's leukemia just melted away. Catherine's had two children since. I see her in clinic from time to time, and there are many hundreds of Western Australians who've received that class of medicines now for that particular type of leukemia. And we have a whole host, there's an explosion of science in cancer medicine, and particularly in hematology at the moment. And so in my department, we've got about 25 clinical trials running at the moment. And this is giving Western Australians access to about 20 or 30 new drugs, all of which are powerfully active against various sorts of blood cancers. It really is astonishing. And yet, it doesn't matter how good the science gets, there's always going to be a human experience involved when you're told you have a cancer, and how you get your head around that and how you choose to tackle that and live your life after that moment. I quote Hippocrates. Hippocrates is regarded as the father of modern medicine because he was the first guy to say, well, we should take a history, collect someone's story and information, and physically examine them in a very methodical way and have a system about it. And he's quoted as saying, cure sometimes, treat often, comfort always. And so if you think about those words, cure sometimes, treat often, comfort always. He's drawing a distinction between curing, which is eradicating disease, and that's the whole Western science model, versus healing, which is getting people to the best place they can get to, considering the hand of cards that they've been dealt. And actually, if you think about it, when we can't cure is when the healing becomes triply, quadruply important. And so I have in my brain a very, very wide definition of healing. And I've learned through Solaris that there are plenty of people in the mainstream health professions who want to heal, but there are a lot of people outside the mainstream health professions who intuitively or by training are also capable of a healing effect in some way. As another example, I have a colleague who's a pathologist. All he does is look down a microscope all day and report our lymphoma biopsies. And I know that he takes an inordinate amount of care about getting the diagnosis absolutely right, because he knows that that affects the treatment decisions and the chance of cure. And in his own way, I very much regard him as a healer too. He's committed to getting people better. One of the great things about Solaris is that it's proven to be a very efficient, if that's the word, way of transducing a wellspring of goodwill in the community to help people with cancer into something that's tangible and immediate with hands-on therapies and so on. There have been some unexpected lessons out of the Solaris experience that we didn't expect. The first one was that for a lot of people who are diagnosed, they're shell-shocked, they wander into Solaris and they're given a cup of tea and somebody just sits and listens for a bit, which in itself has therapeutic value. And then there's an offer, why don't you try a session a week of this or this or this, whatever you want. And people will sit there and say, oh, well, okay, maybe I'll try that one. And there's a moment here where somebody who's felt helpless and that the system and their body have imposed this terrible thing upon them can start to make choices to manage their way out of the situation. The psychological term for this is empowerment. And from my point of view as a physician, to see somebody who's empowered to manage their illness is so much less distressing for them than somebody who still has that rabbit in the spotlights. I don't know what to do, I don't know where to go, look about them. This is a very real thing. The second thing that's been surprising from Solaris is that it provides community. And I've come to see through Solaris how important a sense of community is. Cancer is mostly a disease of the elderly. It's often a disease of empty nesters, somebody whose partner may or may not be able to cope with the diagnosis. The kids have left home, and it can be an incredibly isolating thing to be told you have cancer, and it can polarise people around you who don't know how to react. And I warn my patients that this can happen. And they walk into Solaris and somebody is able to start talking to them who knows what they're going through and who knows roughly where they're at and isn't afraid of using the bad words and the possibility of bad outcomes, and doesn't just glibly say, well, we're going to fight this, aren't they? We're going to have a positive mental attitude, which is a very destructive idea, actually. If you think about it, it seems odd to say this in this environment, but to a large extent in Australian society, we've lost formal religion. We've certainly lost the Christian church in terms of the extent it had 100 years ago. We've lost villages, we've lost extended families, and a lot of that's been replaced by social media and electronic communication, and neither of those cut the mustard in this situation. However useful social media and electronic communication is, people need human interaction to cope with this situation. And so one of the things that we've learned about Solaris is that it provides this sense of community for some people that otherwise don't have it. And I've come to see that we need to do all we can in our society to find ways to recreate communities for people, and tonight is very much a case in point. All right, I've rambled and gone way off track here. I think I should probably start finishing up, but I just want to say some practical things. If you know somebody with cancer, my advice to you is as follows. Number one, respect their choice. They have the right to choose how they will manage their illness, and nobody else, myself included, can tell them how they should be doing this. Second thing I say is touch them. I don't mean a running bear hug from 30 metres, but a pat on the back or a little hug. It's a very powerful form of human communication. The third thing I would say is, if possible, recommend that they get somebody else outside their immediate household as a spokesperson. If they do have a large family and a lot of relatives might be overseas, ringing all the time, the effect of that is they have to talk about their cancer all the time. And so I suggest to people that they appoint a spokesperson outside the household who's updated and can provide, everyone else can ring them and just leave them alone. The most useful practical help for somebody with cancer is pre-cooked meals, transport and childcare. Those are the most useful things for sure. A side project that I've become involved with from the learnings of Solaris and how to get over the barriers of this mind-body split has been the notion of arts and healing. And we are increasingly learning that we can use performing, written, visual, photographic, musical arts to promote the healing process. And some of these can be really quite striking. And so I'll give you a great example from the United Kingdom where they have a program called the Breathe Magic program. And this was designed for kids with cerebral palsy. And instead of treating them with the traditional occupational therapy and Botox injections and physiotherapy, instead they taught them magic. And so they got magicians to come in, they'd expose the kids to a two-week camp, teach them magic tricks, and then they compared that to the standard OT, physio, Botox injections to relieve muscle spasm. And they actually showed much better outcomes, such that kids who did the camp, at the end of the camp, instead of only 25% of them using the bad side of their body, 93% were, because they needed both hands to do the tricks. 3 months later, it was still at 83%, far better than with standard treatment. And so actually now across the UK, they've replaced OT and physio increasingly with the Breathe Magic campaign. And it's a fantastic example. And you can imagine from the kids' point of view how they feel where they've got magic tricks that they can show their parents and their brother and their sister and their friends and the self-esteem that they must engender. Another example closer to home, at the old kids' hospital, they did a program of x-raying VIPs, which were very important patients, which were the kids' teddy bears and toys. And so they'd get the kids who had to come for an x-ray and they'd ask them to bring their toy and they'd x-ray the kids' teddy bear with a splint on the arm. I've got a great slide of this. And they put all of the x-rays in the hall outside the x-ray department. And they found that it made the kids enjoy this otherwise quite scary experience of having x-rays done. It gave them and their nurse something to talk about. I could use psychobabble words like validation and so on, but it was a way, again, of creating a situation in a formal hospital environment where people are stopped talking about illness and they're talking about something that is human, which I think is terribly important. And I have a vision that we could make a far richer society by doing these sorts of things. I would love to see plays put on in hospitals and see patients and staff talking about how they read the play and what they got out of it and so on. There's a lot of other things that I could talk about. I had meant to say more along the way. If you are interested in this kind of area, there are three or four books I'd recommend. There's a book called The Emperor of All Maladies by Siddhartha Mukherjee, who's an oncology fellow in New York. It's a history of cancer. And it's the most incredible book, and he writes beautifully and warmly. There's a very sad but very powerful book by a young neurosurgeon, Paul Kalanithi, the book's called When Breath Becomes Air, and he was diagnosed with a non-smoking related lung cancer in his early 30s. And he spent several years trying to find what it was in life that was meaningful. And he writes about this in very eloquent terms in his book before he died. And actually, the book Sapiens, I've written down the author here, Yuval Noah Harari, is a history of humankind. I mention this because of your society. At the end of this book, the author, who's an anthropologist and archaeologist in Israel, poses a question as to whether human evolution is making us happier. A fantastic question. And there's a paragraph in the book about the Buddhist notion that if you're chasing happiness, you've already lost the game. And he just a fantastic, very powerful paragraph, which really brought home to me this idea that to aim for something in this sphere is just setting yourself up to fail. And much more, I thought his description of the Buddhist philosophy of just sitting with things and accepting the way things are is actually going to be a much better way to tackle a situation. All right, so look, I've rambled. I've told you about Solaris. From my point of view, I made changes in my own medical practice. I restructured my clinics. I do what's called the bad news interview twice so that people can assimilate the information better. I have a photograph in my consulting room at Charlie's, which is a pretty boring photograph hanging on the wall of some grass and trees, but it's actually a scene in India that I took when I was 19 on the back of an elephant on a tiger hunt in the Royal Chitwan National Park. And I have the photo there and I look at it before clinic to remind myself of what I was like at that age before the artifice of medicine, and to say fundamentally we are people first and health professional second. And my philosophy is that in my work, there are two people in the room, hopefully a carer and other people as well, but basically two people, somebody who's sick and somebody who wants to help them. And I redrew the line, I metaphorically took off the white coat. The dogma was in cancer medicine when I went through that, if you get too close to your patients, you'll burn out. And so you have to emotionally hold back. And I felt that that wasn't working for me. And so if I find a friendship is developing with a patient, to a certain point, I'll let that happen. And I'll talk about my band or my kids or the footy or... because I think the expression of humanity is terribly, terribly important in healthcare. That's probably a good note to finish on. Thanks for listening to my waffle, and I'm very happy to take questions for as long as you want.
Thank you for... Hello.
Yep.
Thank you so much for coming tonight and for setting up Solaris. My heart goes out to you. I have friends that actually are volunteers there. And I'm a Reiki person. And I'll just share a little bit about how Reiki has worked. It was founded by a Japanese Buddhist monk who wanted to help humanity. And he went into a cave and meditated for many months. And he came out feeling that he just didn't know, but he fell over and he bumped his toe. And he bent down, touched it, and these symbols came to him and he healed and he realised that's when Reiki started. So it's these symbols that we actually tap into through certain, through certain initiations of healing energy. But I'd like to say everyone has got healing. There's healing energy for everybody. You don't have to be a Reiki person. You can just, by sending love, and sending prayer, and sending kindness, sending just touch, everyone has got the healing energy. And it's just such a beautiful thing to be able to you know, to share this with people, and for you as a doctor, as a hematologist, to, you know, to accept that this healing energy, even though you don't understand how it works, but to know that it, through love, through compassion, through the touch, through healing, people's kind words. But look, everyone prayers. I belong to a group. We chant for people every Monday night. We meet and we chant, and people get better. And you know, just through my own daughter got better through chanting. So yeah, thank you so much. And I just think it's wonderful. You're a wonderful humanitarian, and it's an honour that you're here tonight. Thank you so much.
Oh, that's very kind. Thank you. This notion of energy is completely anathema to the medical profession. And there are very strong reasons for that. The first is that it's not in any of the textbooks we've read. It's not in any of the exams we've sat. It's not in any of the specialist exams we've sat. It's not in any of the literature that we read and have to read day in, day out to keep up. And it's not part of Christian religion, this energy concept. It's very much an Eastern concept. And if I drop that word into a talk of medical people, then I lose them. You can see about half of them, the body language just, oh, energy, no, not for me. And yet, and I say this to people, 80% of Perth GPs are quite happy to prescribe acupuncture. Acupuncture has been proven to be effective in certain clinical situations. If you do an MRI or a positron emission tomographic PET scan of someone's brain getting acupuncture, it changes. You can see measurable effects on the brain. As opposed to people have done a randomised control trial with sham acupuncture needles, like stage daggers, where the needle disappears inside the hilt of the acupuncture needle. And yet, acupuncture is based on the Chinese concept of lines of energy in the body. And if I say that to doctors, then a few of them start to get that, oh, maybe I've missed something here. My own take on this energy thing is that it's some kind of subtle aspect of what I would call the immune system. And I don't want to take the magic out of it. I just am trying, according to the training I've had and the knowledge I have, to understand it, I guess. But I told you about the Aboriginal man who died. We don't have all the answers. And it just seems to me, if you set yourself up like the Friends of Science in Medicine to say, well, we mustn't teach Reiki in university because there's no scientific rationale for it, then we're actually limiting ourselves to our current knowledge base, and we'll never expand it. My attitude is to say, let's do it, measure it, and if it's safe and it's having some benefit, then we'll keep doing it. There's a drug called thalidomide that for years we didn't know how it worked in myeloma. We gave it because it worked. Now we know that there's a particular molecular pathway on one side of a lymphocyte versus another side and so on. So there are plenty of things we've done in medicine that we didn't know how they worked. But there's a prejudice. There's a very clear prejudice. And partly it's on behalf of people with cancer that we don't want to see them exploited by charlatans. But it is dissolving. And when I started Solaris, I got a lot of pushback. I had a lot of letters from concerned colleagues that patients were being exposed to quackery. I would always go and speak to those people in their departments and set up my basis as I have tonight, basically. And most of them are comfortable with it at the end. We're very clear that we're not claiming cures, we're not claiming that kind of impact. It's much more, and our evidence that we've published is greatly reduced cancer symptoms and psychological distress scores and so on. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry for my English is not so great, but I'll try to say it in English. English is not my
I'm sure whatever is your first language is much worse for me.
Yeah. Your sharing remind me of someone that I encountered with cancer. And it's very sad, her situation, because her daughter using drugs, so occasionally using drugs, so tend to be abusive to her. And she live alone. She often feel that her daughter only want her to pass away so her daughter can take her house. So she often share that feeling. So, and also I noticed that after chemotherapy, she's very weak and the whole house is so messy. So she doesn't have the energy to clean the house and she doesn't get out. So how do you, I don't know what happened to her now, but last time I went there, I get depressed as well around her.
You, what happened?
I don't know what happened with her now, but last time I'm trying to be her friend, but each time I come to her house, I get depressed myself because she's so stressed. But this, like, this person is like stay in my mind. Like, I feel like people like that, I think here, like in Australia, people feel so lonely. Like, I'm from Indonesia, so we have a big family. So it's everybody around you. So you feel all this social interaction. And here is like a little bit to feel lonely, more lonely. I feel lonely here as well. It's hard to make friendship here. It's hard to connect with people. People are very nice, but you cannot get close to them. So this lady, she is old, and she is, I think, her bills for the medication is a lot. So she's also thinking about financial situation and her daughter using drugs, so a little bit violent to her, and all this problem, the house is so messy, and she doesn't get out. So how do you help such person? Because you try to talk to them, but you yourself doesn't want to be so stressed because they bring you so down because they are, like you say, that if someone is hopeful, they are not hopeless. They feel a little bit better about their situation and maybe they can in a better situation.
Sure.
But
yeah.
But this lady, so last time I give up because I came to her house. I know her from someone in church. I'm Catholic, by the way. So I came to her house. I offered her, if you need me, I wash the dishes for her, buying her lunch. But after some time, I don't want to feel down and stressed and depressed, so I don't visit her anymore.
Yeah, so look, you can only do what you can do. And if you go into the negative with helping somebody, sooner or later that'll backfire on both of you. So don't feel guilty that you can't come up with a whole solution. I mean, this is an incredibly difficult situation. We have this growing awareness of what we call financial toxicity of treatment. So in the same way, if we give a new drug, it can upset the liver or it can drop the blood counts, and we talk about toxicity of different parts of the body. The American Society of Clinical Oncology has published grades of financial toxicity. And I remember one of the things we've done in Solaris is start something called the Chemo Club, which is exercises for people, free exercise class for people during their chemo. And I was talking to a lady at the start of the session, walking around the Oval, and she said that she was a social worker, so she knows all of the system, but she'd had to sell a house to cover the cost of her treatment. Your friend, somehow there should be some kind of social worker available with the team, particularly if it's in the public system, which is actually better for this kind of situation.
She got like a nurse or something come to her house, I think, twice a week, something like
that. Okay, but there must be a doctor somewhere supervising, and there should be a social worker as part of that team that, you know, the nurse should flag this as an issue. Sometimes we can't help. I've We've had people come onto the ward for the next round of their treatment for leukemia and learnt that they spent the last week in their car, just sleeping in the car because they've got nowhere else to go. There's more of this sort of thing happening than we realise, sadly. But that's a terrible situation. And of course, depending on the drug, drugs are very dehumanising and they just take over someone. That's a terrible situation. But you should do what you can. Try and keep the door open with your friend. One thing you might suggest is get a bunch of people together and go around and clean the house up for her once a fortnight. With a bunch of people, make it a social occasion. She might be feeling terrible because she looks all different or feels so bad, and that's embarrassing. But I think if you can show that you're able to be open-minded and just go in there, and maybe that might be a very practical way you could help. Yeah. Any other questions?
Thank you very much for tonight's talk, Dr. Joski. I looked up your TEDx talk recently.
Tonight was the long version.
As a medical researcher, I'm very heartened by what you're saying about bringing the body and the mind back together.
Yes.
Because I always felt we're focused so much on the therapy, but we're not actually looking at the whole human being. And I was curious, are you familiar with the work by Dr. Bruce Lipton, who did some very elegant cell culture experiments at Stanford, where he basically showed that a cell can't be in a state of growth and protection at the same time? And extrapolated from there, saying that is the mindset is so important in how a disease or how someone how disease progresses. If you're looking at extrapolating again to epigenetics, the thoughts, the feelings, the biochemistry, and how all of that fits together. So I guess it's not so much a question, maybe more of a comment on how that actually fits together with what you're doing with Solaris. And I was curious when you talked about the neuropsychoimmunology, whether you're referring to the work of Dr. Candace Pert at NIH, the molecules of emotions?
There are several.
Yeah.
All right, there's heaps of things I can say in response to that. And I think it's fair to say that there's not conflicting, but apparently contradictory evidence. So. The first thing I would tackle is the positive mental attitude. Every cancer patient has everyone around them saying, you've got to beat this, you've got to show a positive mental attitude. There isn't any evidence that coping style, in a psychological sense, changes cancer outcomes. So there's been a big analysis done by a guy called Pettigrew and published in about 2002. And for a lot of cancer patients, they feel like crap. They've just had treatment, they're exhausted, and somebody telling them to be positive is the last thing they want to hear. And worse, they can start to feel guilty that they're not reflecting what everyone else around them is saying them. So I will say this to my patients with as many family members present as possible and say, actually, I don't believe in the positive mental attitude. I think what is more important, and that surprises people because I'm kind of the poster boy for the psychological stuff, but I've come to the view that what is important is that people need to be able to get to a point where they're calm about the diagnosis. So you wake up and then it hits you like a train again. Oh God, I've got this tumour, my body's turned against me and I've got this horrible treatment. But I understand the mainstream medical plan. I understand what the treatment is and what it involves and what it's trying to achieve, hopefully. And then I'm doing this, this, and this for myself. This is my own plan, what I call lifestyle management of my cancer. And so by having a plan, the pulse starts to settle down a bit and people say, okay, so yes, there's this horrible thing there, but we've got a plan in place and let's just follow that. As a corollary to that, I found that the people who cope best with the whole thing are not those who follow every result and fixate upon every outcome and worry about the biopsy in 3 months' time that's going to show how it's gone. But instead other people who kind of say, okay, in 4 months I'm going to be on a beach in Bali, sunning myself, and until I get to that day, I'm just going to take it day by day and take the pressure off themselves for outcomes and so on. And I think that is a reasonably Buddhist notion. I could be wrong. It's probably more Zen than Buddhist, but I think there's a lot to be learned from that approach. So the positive mental attitude thing, I think is a very destructive notion. On the flip side, there's evidence, if you put a cell culture into mice and isolate one mouse from all of its everyone else, the tumour will grow faster. So the headline for this in the lay press was, loneliness promotes cancer growth. And that's probably true, actually. So there's kind of a duality here, and it's probably a lot more nuanced than just must be positive or not. They did a fantastic study where they took men who'd had prostate cancer. So their prostate gland was in a state where it had turned cancerous. And their prostate, the cancerous part of it had been chopped out. And then they put the men on an exercise program and re-biopsied the prostate gland and showed that in the remainder of the prostate gland, by doing exercise, it changed the expression of a whole lot of genes inside the cells. And actually, I've come to think that the best single thing somebody with cancer can do to help themselves is exercise. And there's strong evidence that high levels of exercise prevents about 20% of breast cancer. It prevents about 10% of colorectal carcinoma relapse. And so exercise is crucial. And it's got to be the right sort of exercise as well. And I could talk about that for a long time. But so there was also a researcher called Temashek who, and I have colleagues who believe this, who say that there are people who are cancer prone. They're kind of fatalistic and miserable and downbeat and everything is, they're victims. Kind of your average Dockers fan, really. And that Temashek hypothesised that these people were more prone to getting cancer, and that's been blown out of the water. There's no evidence that personality type predisposes to cancer. As far as stress goes, there is a bit of evidence that stress might increase the rate of growth of a cancer if it's already there. There's not very strong evidence at all that stress itself can cause cancer. So again, it's not just a simple yes-no binary type of thing. It's pretty complicated, and it probably varies from person to person and from cancer to cancer and cancer type to cancer type. And even within a cancer type, each individual tumour pathway, and they're all different. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, it's every patient is always different. I mean, even you spoke about mice. I've done a lot of work in that area, even though inbred mice, every single one in the same litter will show a completely different pathology, even though they're identical. I'm just curious, would you say that it's more, we talked about mindset. I felt that empowering patients about feeling they have some impact on their own health and that they have options and things they can do, like with Solaris, that really is a major factor, positive factor?
Yeah, but it's positive because it makes the experience, the journey, more bearable. So I'm not saying it's positive that in that it's going to increase the chance of cure. But for me, if I have somebody coming in who's still looking at their toes and doesn't know where to go and terrified of what I'm going to say versus somebody who's coming in and saying, okay, I understand the situation and what we're trying to achieve and I'm with you, Doc, about this, it's chalk and cheese. But it might sadly still be a bad outcome in either case.
Hello. I just want to share my experience In 2001, I actually worked at the cancer, Brown's Cancer Foundation, but I was under the supervisor, David, and I did every Friday. So I was a student studying psychology then, and I did Reiki 1 and 2. But I had one particular patient that comes in on Friday, and he was a professor of UWA, and he said, I don't know what all this bullshit is, he said, but I just want you to know that I gave up earning $450 an hour just to be here. So what can you do? So I said to him, well, well done for being here. And so we proceed with half an hour of counseling and then half an hour of Reiki. Thereafter, he would come every Friday and he booked the same time with me. And I remember him saying to me, this is very touching. He said to me, after Reiki, it's like I've taken marijuana. He says, I just float all the way home.
Yes.
So to me, that's just rewarding to hear. I worked there for, I gave my voluntary work for a year. And I think I might like to contact Solaris and give more voluntary work if I may.
Well, firstly, well, lots of things. Firstly, thank you. Secondly, I'm sure it's actually everybody's experience. When we decide to volunteer and give of ourselves for something, I think I speak for all of us, you always find you get more back than you put in. And so I think the process of volunteering is something that should be encouraged for all of us. The next thing I would say is that I've tried Reiki as a patient. When I try most things in Solaris, I fall asleep. The therapists tell me that's okay. But we've done some research that shows that people kind of, it's an oasis. And whether it is the therapeutic relationship, which you've described actually, the fact that somebody's prepared to give up an hour of their own time. A lot of people who do these sorts of therapies don't have big incomes, and for them to volunteer, and we have volunteers who are still with us 15 years later, for them to volunteer their time a morning a week is a big deal. Whether it's just this volunteer effect, because we don't charge, and I don't want to charge, and our therapists, each time we survey them, don't want to charge people, I don't care. But so long as it's helping, I think that's the key thing, and it clearly does.
I'd just like to add to the cancer support. I used to teach meditation, and I did belly dancing there with the women, and it was so wonderful to see these women, you know, dressing up and, you know, in between operations and losing, you know, having mastectomies, and but just the joy of dance. And you know, I'm a yoga, tai chi, qigong, kickboxing, bit of belly dancing, because I believe in that exercise. I mean, I could do Reiki and that, but I do believe that I bring in the joy through the exercise. And also, I'd just like to, what are your thoughts on laughter therapy? Because Norman Cousins wrote a book about it, that he I think he had cancer, and he spent a whole weekend just getting laughter videos, well, comedy, you know, humour, and that he actually cured himself. I don't know if that is the exact story, but something like that you know, comedy, that humour, laughter is the best medicine. And I've also taught laughter yoga as well. Yeah.
Yeah, we had a meeting of our Solaris Research Committee yesterday, and we are looking at a project with, you might know Yanni, to look at whether we can do a Solaris kind of sponsored program of laughter therapy in the kids' hospital, which is something new for Solaris. But now that they're co-located with our first centre at Charlie's, it's logical to see if we can help there as well. I have to say, one session of laughter therapy that I went to, I didn't do it for me. I found it forced, to be honest. Maybe I didn't persist long enough. Maybe I was stressed out at the time. It's a bit like, you know, enjoying a bad movie. You've got to get over that point and then just go with it, I think. And I didn't get to the point on that particular day. Yeah. Absolutely. No question. Yeah.
I just want to share my experience about Qigong. A few years ago, I participated and practiced Qigong for about 2 years. Back then, I had a very very stressful job as a project manager in the mining industry here. And I was exercised all my life. I'm other form of more conventional exercises like body weights and running and cardio and all of that.
Yep.
I even practice a bit of yoga every now and then, but I must say I felt that there's something in Qigong, there's something healing in Qigong, something very soothing, I would say even purifying. I just remember those Thursdays when of the Qigong class. And then I had the energy to, and I could go for another week. And there's also that, the fact that it's practiced in a group, and there's more that social interaction.
Yes, I think it's important, yeah.
In it. That's...
Yeah, I'm a fan of Qigong. I imagine there's probably different varieties of it as well. You know, a lot of the movements in Qigong are actually like singing, the big expansion and so on. And I mentioned the study about the cancer patient singing in choirs and so on. There's evidence that the immune system reacts within 10 or 20 seconds of that, of starting singing. And to get back to the energy concept, I remember 1 year walking around the wards just before Christmas, and the wards were flat, the hospital was in a rough time, and the mood was terrible. And I walked into our Solaris Centre, and there was a whole lot of people sitting there around the guitar singing, and the energy in the room just hit like a wall. So there's clearly something in the energy thing. But as regards your experience, I think they're probably different keys for each of us, as to one or another of different sorts of therapies or massages or breathing techniques or meditation techniques, just are the right key for that, for a particular person and where your brain is at the moment. In the therapeutic setting, as far as meditation goes, we've moved away from the old style meditation of trying to clear your mind and achieve calmness and emptiness to mindfulness. And I think you've got somebody speaking at the conference tomorrow even. There's a mindfulness conference tomorrow in Harborne Street. And so mindfulness is a different kind of meditation where you let things come into your head, but you try and stand back and look at it as if it's a play on stage or a screen, and just look at it and then let the next thought come in and look at it and so on without judging. Or mindfulness can be anything that takes you away completely into an activity which then becomes the only thing you're doing. And for me, it's playing guitar. And so when I'm playing guitar, nothing else in the universe exists. And that's just the perfect therapy for me because I'm far too cerebral most of the time. You've probably all seen, there's a TEDx talk by a monk who was he's French, but he was a molecular biologist. Yeah, you would have seen it. And in the TEDx talk, he explains that when they do brain traces of these were Tibetan monks, this is where he'd gone, they show that, I think it's the delta waves that are associated with happiness were massively amplified in the monks who meditated. And he makes a comparison in his TED talk between if you're a violinist and you're practicing 8 hours a day, then that part of your brain that controls fine finger movements becomes massively enlarged so that you can play the violin so well. And he was saying that the evidence is that in these monks, where they meditated in a certain way, the part of the brain that's associated with happiness or satisfaction was massively enlarged. That's a fascinating observation and a pretty good argument for doing some kind of meditation. I struggle with the old style meditation, I'm afraid. My brain's still too noisy. I'm working at it, but for me, the mindfulness thing with the music's the perfect way out. And I write songs about the people I look after and about my work, and I've sung them at conferences as well. It's very meaningful for me. I nearly brought my guitar tonight, actually. All right, a lot of people are gone. I think that probably is enough, isn't it? Thank you.